Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn about the meat we eat today by looking back on its production and consumption over the past three centuries? Well before the United States was an independent nation, European immigrants to this country were delighted to find excellent conditions for hunting and ample land on which to farm imported breeds. Even as the majority of us have moved to urban areas and stopped tracking our own prey and raising our own livestock, we have continued to view an ample and inexpensive supply of meat as a sort of American birthright, which my guest today will tell us has led to some unintended consequences. Historian Maureen Ogle is the author of the new book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. Maureen, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Why is meat such a controversial subject in the first place?
Oh, well, my standard answer is because we want it, and because we want it, we're going to do what it takes to get it. And these days, there are many, many well-intentioned people who would prefer that we, at least, bare minimum, significantly reduce how much meat we eat.
One thing that's fascinating to me about this story is that as we look into these questions that we all have about the safety and the health value and the ethics of meat, it turns out that it has long been a much more complicated story than we have wanted to believe.
That's right. And I'll just give your listeners a little background. I'm a historian. I'm not a journalist or a food activist or anything even remotely resembling that. I'm just a historian. And when I started this book 7 years ago, I knew absolutely nothing about anything that's in the book. And I was, when I would tell people I was working on this book, they would say, oh, well, you know, big corporations are out there, you know, forcing this bad meat down our throats, et cetera. And I was genuinely surprised to find, A, that's not the case, and B, just how incredibly complicated not just the meat system, but our entire food system is. That was really my big takeaway from this. The logistics of the abundance in our country is amazingly complex.
I was fascinated to learn that our meat consumption was one of the first things that distinguished settlers in this country from their families back home. Even culturally, we've essentially been eating our weight in meat every year since before the Declaration of Independence.
That's right. And I was surprised to find that, too. When I started the book, I actually wasn't quite sure where I was going to start it. But once I discovered that colonial Americans devoted a tremendous amount of political and social energy and a lot of flat-out conflict, armed conflict, to making the colonies a paradise of meat, I was genuinely surprised by that.
And I guess the idea was simply they could have it, so why wouldn't they?
That's right. When colonists got here, they came, of course, from Europe and from England. And what they came from was a world of scarcity, where food scarcities were routine and where the vast majority of people rarely ate meat. And by rarely, I mean perhaps only a few times a year. But when they got here, I am convinced as a historian, their greatest cultural shock had to have been just the sheer abundance of land. And they also, however, encountered Native Americans, people that they called savages, and discovered to their dismay that those natives had no domestic livestock at all. And that was enough for white Americans to believe that, okay, these natives have done nothing with the land. Because to a European, civilization, a marker of civilization was domestic livestock and livestock husbandry. And the settlers to the New World found none of that. And no less a person than William Bradford, at the time revered and still very famous leader of one of the Massachusetts colonies, flat out said the Indians have raised no livestock, they have no barns, they have no fences, therefore they have no axe, they have no right to the land. It's ours. And an extraordinary amount of armed conflict ensued because of that very point. Settlers thought they should use the land for livestock, and that meant pushing Indians out into the deeper into the interior, where, of course, they collided with other Indian groups. And a tremendous amount of the warfare in colonial America was staged and spurred by the need for land to raise livestock.
Amazing. And those attitudes were shaped by the fact that we associated meat with civilization.
That's right. That's right. I mean, who knew? On such small things, many things can turn. Yeah. Who knew?
So what kinds of livestock did the settlers bring with them? And how much, once they realized the abundance of wild prey out there, how much did they supplement what they were raising with what they could hunt?
Well, ironically, or perhaps not, many of those first groups of settlers actually brought no livestock at all with them, partly because they knew that the odds were the livestock would not survive the trip. Remember, this is the early 17th century, and sailing from even the far west coast of England to North America was a journey that took weeks and months.
And human passengers often didn't make it.
Right, exactly. That's right. It was not uncommon for half the passengers to die as well, the two-legged passengers. So, for example, the people who settled the Plymouth colony brought no livestock at all on their first trip, and that's one reason why they had a really hard time that first year. They also were not prepared for the weather. And they immediately rectified that. And every ship that came thereafter, every boat that came thereafter, firm orders, bring us some livestock. And what colonists very quickly realized was that the livestock that survived the trip and arrived in the New World reproduced very quickly because there was just so much land, and hogs actually became a problem. There were so many hogs, they were just a nuisance to everybody. But cattle, for example, reproduced very quickly.
Can you talk about this? For a long time, as we have decided whether it's good to eat meat or bad to eat meat or what kind of meat to eat, we have always tied our justifications to the health value or lack thereof of meat eating. Can you talk a little bit about how those have shifted over time?
Yeah, until really the 19th century, the late 1800s, no one really questioned the value of meat. Meat was what Americans ate. Mm-hmm. They ate it as often as they could, and they ate more of it than anybody in the world. In the late 19th century, for the first time, researchers in both Europe and in the United States began to try to unravel the scientific mysteries of nutrition, a science we now, of course, take completely for granted. And at about 120 years ago, the understanding was that the most important food for humans was protein, and the most important, best way to get that protein was through meat, particularly beef, as opposed to pork or poultry. Starting in the early 20th century, right around 1910 or thereabouts, that view of meat in our diet came for the first time, was being challenged because a Polish chemist discovered what we now call vitamins. Again, we take all this for granted. 100 years ago, vitamins were completely mysterious. Scientists figured there was something else in food, but they weren't quite sure what it was. And lo and behold, it turned out to be what we now call vitamins. And that presented kind of a challenge to meat, because for the first time, instead of eating meat as much as you could, many nutritionists were saying, we'd better start eating some vegetables too. And at the time, Americans had what was arguably the most diverse diet in the world. Ironically, I won't get off the subject with this, but ironically, in part because of the big meat packers who used their distribution systems to ship all manner of foods to the great cities in America, from California clear out to the East Coast. Meat, of course, never really lost its supremacy. There was a challenge to it, but it didn't lose its supremacy until the 1970s. And in the late 70s, for the first time, through a series of events, which I do detail in the book, but I won't go into them here, for the very first time, meat was regarded as just flat out unhealthy, particularly beef, which had long been the most important meat, greatly outweighing either pork or poultry in Americans' diets. And from that moment, the beef consumption in this country literally plunged. It fell way off a cliff, way off a cliff. And that is the moment when poultry became Americans' favorite meat, because in the sort of ethos of the 1970s nutritional advice, it was okay to eat poultry, chicken, because it was lower in fat and it was better for you. And that was when we made this great shift. But all Americans did was substitute poultry for beef. Their consumption of meat products never went down.
That's really interesting. Can you talk about why it took like the Great Depression and World War II to really mechanize a lot of meat production in this country?
Yes, that to me, well, that turned out to be the big surprise for me among many, many surprises, and also in many ways the most complex part of the entire story. And it's why I ended up devoting a fair amount of print to explaining where these now much reviled factory farms came from. Here's the crux of it, boiled down. We live in an urban nation, and that's something that is so, it's like air to us or water to a fish. We don't even think about it. The overwhelming majority of us live in cities. Here's the thing that's so obvious about city dwellers that we don't think of it. We don't produce our own food. We rely on someone else to do it. And as cities got bigger and more people moved to town, there were fewer farmers to feed those people. And the chronic gap between supplies of food from farmers and the demand from urban populations drove up food prices, but it also forced farmers to realize that if they were going to survive at all, they had to change the way they conducted all of their farming, but in particular their livestock production. They did not have enough labor to conduct the kinds of farms that, you know, now many people have this idyllic vision of what a farm should be. Mm-hmm. We haven't had farms like that for 150 years. So farmers were pressed by urban demand on one hand, by lack of labor on the other. And I can't stress how important that was. There was just a constant, and still is now, a constant labor shortage. And the way to replace labor when you don't have it is by mechanization and by automation. So those two things together pushed farmers to a position where they had to create a new kind of farming, and they called it, with pride at the time, factory farming. Hmm. Of course, you know, nowadays someone would probably fall over in a dead faint if you said anything positive about a factory farm.
Well, you know, Maureen, I just thought this was so fascinating because we as a society were demanding this. Like the Industrial Revolution happens and everything else is put on an assembly line. And why the question back then was, why can't these farmers get it together and do things the way Henry Ford's doing it?
That's right. It was called Fordized farming. And my favorite quote in the entire book is something like, agriculture is the last great nest of chaos. This was about 106 years ago. Teddy Roosevelt even appointed a very important commission to investigate what the heck is the matter. What is going on in rural America that you people cannot figure out how to feed all of us? It was really an issue. And again, we have so much food now that we just take it for granted. We don't even think about this stuff anymore. But for a very long period of time, there was just a chronic gap between the two, and there was simply a demand for farmers to get their modern act together and act more like factories. And farmers who didn't want to do that did not stay in business or decided that wasn't the kind of farming they wanted. But farmers who were committed to farming eagerly embraced the entire notion of factory farming.
My guest today is historian Maureen Ogle. She joins us from the studios of WOI in Ames, Iowa, and she's the author of a new book called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or send email to think@kera.org.
funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Human Rights, Creative Writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Maureen Ogle. She is author of the new book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Maureen, at the time that our meat was raised on those idyllic family farms that may or may not have ever been so idyllic.
Right.
You know, you raised meat for your family. You might have sold a few animals down the road or prepared things for neighbors, but basically it was a localized operation, and people did the butchering themselves. Then when you get large urban populations, suddenly you require the sort of outsourcing of this function. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that started way earlier than I would have expected. As soon as the American Revolution, by the time the American Revolution ended, Americans had already built a very sophisticated system of raising cattle and finishing them on corn. Sorry, everybody, it goes back that far.
So they weren't grass-fed way back when.
They pastured on grass in the summer and were finished on corn. And colonists did that the whole time. One of the reasons they did that was because there were next to no roads at the time, and the cattle had to walk to market, a journey that could take weeks. And cattle raised on grass arrived at market, if they arrived at all, about half dead. And cattle that were finished on corn arrived at market blooming. So that was that. So there was a system in place for supplying the port cities in North America even before the American Revolution, not just to supply meat to those people living in those towns in the ports, but also because by 1650, Americans already had a hefty global market in shipping barreled and beefed pork. So there was a well-established meat-making industry where farmers were raising livestock not for subsistence but for commercial purposes, even before the Revolution. Once the Revolution ended, there was even more land because, of course, as terms of the treaty, the United States got a big chunk of what is now the United States, and Americans poured out of the eastern seaboard down into the Ohio River Valley, where they found perfect and very fertile land for raising grain, especially corn, and for grazing and finishing cattle on corn, and also for raising hogs, which were being purpose-raised so that they could be slaughtered in a very, very busy slaughtering industry ranged along the Ohio River, particularly in southern Ohio. And again, much of that meat was shipped out of the United States around the world. So there was already a very hefty market way before we would all have expected one.
How did commercially processed meats, things like sausages, become such a mainstay of working class diets in particular?
Here's the deal with a carcass. When you slaughter an animal, I'm just going to leave poultry out of this. I'm going to speak to beef and pork. When you slaughter a hog or a steer, not all of that animal is edible. Obviously, there's a lot that's not: hoof, bone, hide, so forth. But Americans were so intent on having the kind of meat they wanted, and that meant things like roast, steak, and so forth, that butchers had a heck of a time getting rid of the rest of the carcass: flank, tongue, the more coarse cuts of meat on both hogs and cattle. And that, plus the arrival of so many German immigrants where sausage was a normal part of life, quickly turned into a very, very busy operation, in effect using the coarse bits, turning them into sausages of all kinds. And those were lower cost because they were made from meats that were not the most more desirable cuts that did cost money. So that has been part of our diet as well. We're actually kind of weirdly a non-sausage eating society now, at least compared to what we were 100 years ago. The other thing I should just toss in here is that for most of the 19th century, both beef and both beef and pork, but especially pork, were actually packed in wooden barrels with salt and preserved because that way they could easily be shipped around the world. But that was also very, very low expensive, low-cost meat, you know, not particularly great quality, the kind that might not taste as good as fresh meat. So Americans on the lower end of the scale had plenty of meat. And when they could, and I have examples of this in the book, when they could, they also demanded tenderloin for themselves.
Yeah, the price of meat has been something that we have always been very, very sensitive to.
Yeah, who knew? I was surprised at how often Americans were willing to take to the streets and throw rocks at butcher shops and launch boycotts to protest price hikes of even, in some cases, just as little as a penny of a pound. And a penny then, say, 110 years ago, being maybe the equivalent of 35 cents now, which doesn't sound like too much to me. By the way, we only spend 2% of our disposable incomes to eat more meat than anybody else in the world. So, we want, it's not just that we want meat when we want it. We also have historically demanded that that meat be very low cost, because otherwise, how can we afford to eat it whenever we want? It's sort of a vicious cycle.
So when meat is made affordable so that you can use all the extra bits, we've always sort of struggled with the idea of knowing how the sausage was made. And there definitely have been times when bad things have happened in meatpacking plants. I was fascinated that, well, let me just ask you this question. How much credit does Upton Sinclair deserve for making the commercial meat supply safe in this country?
Zero, as far as I'm concerned.
It shocked me. I'm not an expert, but.
Well, I say jokingly, I think I'm the only American who went to an American high school who never read The Jungle. So I slogged my way through it so I could find out what it was all about. And it was a slog. But I've been a historian for many, many years, so I wasn't surprised to discover that the whole Upton Sinclair Jungle Food Inspection Act of 1906, you know, that he actually had pretty much next to nothing to do with it. What he really wanted to do was become a best-selling author, and that was very convenient for Teddy Roosevelt, who was trying to get a food safety, not necessarily a meat safety, but a food safety bill passed, because there was public pressure for food safety in general, and Upton Sinclair turned out to be very useful to Teddy Roosevelt. He drove Teddy Roosevelt completely insane while he was doing it, but Upton Sinclair actually had pretty much nothing to do with anything.
So were things as bad as what he described, even if he was riding a wave of popular sentiment?
Of course, it's impossible to know since I wasn't there. Frankly, I rather doubt it, but let me sort of break that down a little bit. Here is always, and this is still true today, the very large meat manufacturers at the time Upton Sinclair was trying to become a best-selling socialist author and become rich and famous.
Well, best-selling socialist author, there's not too many.
Right, exactly. I'm not too kind to him in the book. I didn't have a lot of patience with the guy. At that time, which again was about 105 or 6 years ago, I completely lost my train of thought. Where was I? I'm sorry. That never happens.
We were talking about the credit he got and how bad things actually were.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, everybody.
It's all right.
Okay. It's been one interview after another.
I'm sure.
Teddy Roosevelt actually sent three groups of commissioners to Chicago to try to verify the claims in Upton Sinclair's book. And he was unable to do that, no matter how hard he tried. And it's impossible to know. Big manufacturers like Armour and Swift, and at the time they were the biggest, along with Wilson and Morris, two names that don't have quite as much historical significance today. Those big manufacturers, I am convinced, would never have allowed the kind of conditions that Upton Sinclair described. Now, smaller packers, And the smaller packers tended to drive the big ones crazy, because the smaller ones tended to be far less scrupulous about sanitation, about dangerous conditions. And a slaughterhouse is dangerous. There's no way you're going to get around that. Between blood on the floor and slippery items and sharp knives, you know, you're looking at an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah.
So I it's I'm sure we could have found, if we could all get in a time machine and go back, we could find packing plants where what Sinclair described was accurate, but did it apply across the board? I rather doubt it. Having said that, a slaughterhouse is a slaughterhouse. You're killing living things. There's bound to be problems, no matter how careful you are.
I didn't realize the margins were so low at slaughterhouses.
You mean the profit margins?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I didn't want to believe that. But the more research I did, and I am persistent, I will just keep burrowing and digging until I find I'll get to the bottom of something. Here is the reality of meat packing. We all want the best cuts. We want bacon. We want, we want beef tenderloin. We want roast. We want steaks. That leaves a lot left over that does not get sold and has to be used in things like sausages. But the cost of getting that fresh meat, or in the case of bacon, for example, or ham, those preserved meats, the best cuts, has always been subsidized in one way or another by something else in the manufacturing operation. And until World War II, meat packers relied on things like the hides. The hides were where they earned their profit. They did not earn any profit at all on the fresh meat. So they had to compensate for that somehow. You can grouse until you're blue in the face about allegedly greedy meat packers. The fact is, they struggle to earn a profit. And frankly, about the only way they can do it is with either lots of byproducts or enormous volume or both. Now, I'll add this to it. Since World War II, the value of those byproducts has plunged because Americans have taken to using various manufactured and chemical substitutes. For example, for a long time, packers sold the blood to be used as fertilizer. They could sell hog thyroids as for medicinal purposes. They earned profit from bone, which could be used for various products. And in the wake of World War II, there was so much research done that many of those let's call them natural products, mm-hmm. went by the wayside. For example, shoe manufacturers stopped using they weren't using nearly as much leather as they has historically used. And that really caused problems for packers because they had to figure out where are we going to make up that price difference? Where are we going to find that profit that has been subsidizing the price of meat and still give Americans cheap meat?
How did the establishment of the USDA change meat production standards in this country?
Well, the USDA was the first cabinet-level post. Not the first. Close to the first. And was created during the Civil War. So it has been around for a very, very long time. And I think, as we all know, it's also been charged with doing entirely too many things that are often at odds with, it's kind of weird to have a department that promotes agriculture on one hand and then also tries to promote nutritional meals on the other hand. It doesn't always work out particularly well. What the USDA spent most of the 19th century and much of the early 20th century doing was protecting the meat supply by protecting the livestock supply. Much of the research at the USDA until really the 1950s was aimed at eradicating livestock diseases. And the inspection system, the one created in 1906 mm-hmm. during the jungle Upton Sinclair situation, was designed to look at live animals, not meat itself. It was designed to weed out animals who were clearly diseased before they could be slaughtered. And as a result, the USDA has been charged with an almost impossible situation. And because it is such an enormous bureaucracy, and of course, because it's also very political, let's face it, when the boss changes or can change every 4 years, it's hard to have continuity in policy. And so it's been extremely difficult for the USDA to try to modernize itself, weirdly enough. And it has shifted to things, for example, ensuring that antibiotics are being used properly. And there's a whole issue right there. In the 1970s, The big concern was hormones used in livestock production. In 1996, there was a devastating E. coli outbreak in Washington State because of a chain restaurant called Jack in the Box. And that was the moment when people said, look, here's the deal. The USDA's really got to figure out how to do microscopic investigations. But even that late date in the 1990s, it was still really hard to alter the inspection system because the USDA is such a complicated body.
So how safe is our meat supply today from contamination?
Well, my personal opinion, and I'm sure many of your listeners are going to disagree, is that it's probably the safest one in the world. And just before everyone calls in and says, well, clearly she's a hired shill, you know, she's being paid to say that. I'm not. Are there problems? Of course there are. But, for example, here's a criticism that's made all the time that packing plant lines move too fast, and the people who are doing the butchering are moving too fast, and they're not taking care enough to make sure that, for example, what's on the hide doesn't actually contaminate the carcass itself. But the reason those packers have to move so fast is because consumers demand that meat be low priced and that there be a lot of it. And the only way packers can meet the demands, and that demand, by the way, is translated to them by grocery stores. Consumers tell grocery stores, we want this, and grocery stores pass the word on to both farmers and packers. Meat packers are caught in a really hard spot. They are moving as fast as they can, providing as much meat as they can. And by the way, the market is still global. And do accidents happen? Absolutely they do. But I believe that the meat that we're eating is primarily safe. I guess if there's one form of protein to worry about, I gather that poultry is sort of a special case because birds are very small and chickens are prone to disease anyway. It's kind of tough with chickens. If there's a problematic source of contaminated meat, it's probably poultry rather than pork or beef.
Historian Maureen Ogle is with us. Her new book is called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, sending a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Maureen Ogle. Her new book is called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have a tweet here from Ricardo who says, the quality or perception of quality of the meat drives where we shop almost entirely. And I wonder, Maureen, what you learned about who has the power in the meat production chain to really set prices and sort of decide how much things are going to cost.
Consumers. I know that's not a popular answer, but consumers do. And again, grocery chains then are forced to respond to that. Grocery chain. I didn't know anything about the history of groceries and, you know, grocery stores in America. And that ended up taking me off in a long detour because I discovered that in the 20th century, it's been grocery chains who have been calling the shots when it comes to how we get not just meat, but all our food on the table. But grocery chains respond entirely to what consumers are telling them they are, you know, they'll buy, what they're leaving on the shelves, what they're taking off the shelves. And I know that's not a popular view. I know it's not. But it's the one, the conclusion after 7 years of research, that's a conclusion I came to.
And it's not a popular view. Why? Because we don't want to feel like what's wrong is partially our fault?
How much time do we have? I think that's part of it, but now's the point where I'm going to get myself into big trouble, and I know
okay.
I am. But as I think that you know, there, as I think most of your viewers probably know, there is an intense debate going on right now about the entire food system. Critics describe our food system as broken. That's their word, not mine. And in particular, they describe the meat system as a total disaster.
Pink slime, et cetera.
That's right. Pink slime, et cetera. Much of that critique has been it's a very complicated critique that is environmental, political, so forth. But fundamentally, if you ask a critic who's to blame, they will say corporations are to blame. It's a classic, and I'm sorry to use this word, it's a classic Marxian argument, for better or for worse, that capital is autonomous and has more power than we humans, and we are just dupes to capital as it moves about the globe, you know, turning us into its victims, and big food controls our kitchens as a result. I personally do not buy that, and I know that Marxist critics have a whole argument to explain why consumers are in fact not the ones calling the shots. Their argument, to strip it down to its essentials, is that we don't have any autonomy because our autonomy has been stripped away from us by capital, which apparently is this, you know, autonomous entity that does whatever it wants. So that's sort of the big word, profound explanation of who's to blame. But the nice thing about the corporate critique is it lets all of us off the hook, right? None of us have to take any responsibility because we're all just witless dupes. We're all victims. So who's to blame? It depends on who you ask.
What did you learn about pink slime and its relationship maybe to the way our ancestors would have had to use meat?
I thought the whole pink slime thing was absolutely fascinating. And just to recap, I think that blogger, I think, lived in either Houston or Dallas. I'm not sure which one. In 2011, celebrity chef Jamie Oliver had a segment on his short-lived American television show. I never saw it. I watched this segment on YouTube, in which he showed his audience how a substance called pink slime by him is made. He took a big piece of meat and he dumped it into a vat of ammonia. And it was quite disgusting. And it was all also, I soon learned, completely inaccurate. And from there, a food activist blogger who lives in Texas picked it up when she found out that the USDA actually serves pink slime in school, sells it for use in school lunch programs. And as they say, all heck broke loose. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. The media coverage was unbelievably distorted, completely inaccurate. I don't think there's a single journalist in this country who bothered to go get a single fact about pink slime. The technical term for it is lean, finely textured beef. The claim was that pink slime was this disgusting pink slimish stuff with a lot of ammonia dumped into it. That's not what it is. And here's what it is. Since the 1970s, as I explained earlier, packers have had a tough time earning a profit, especially as they lost their byproducts. And so it behooved them to figure out how to use every single bit of a carcass if they possibly could. And in the 70s, a technique was developed using tiny, tiny blades to scrape a carcass to get everything possible off there so that those meat scraps could be used in ground beef. Consumer advocates objected to that and forced the USDA to stop, you know, to rescind its permission for the meat packers to use that. And instead, a guy named Eldon Roth invented a process using centrifugal force to strip carcasses of every single last bit of fat, gristle, everything, and then use that centrifugal force to separate out everything except the meat itself. And then he pressed all those meat scraps into cubes, and he would sell them to meat packers, who then used it, because it was varying contents of fat, would use it to make ground beef. In the 1990s, after the Jack in the Box incident and people became more afraid of E. coli, Eldon Roth invented a way to use a quick blast of ammonia. And by the way, ammonia is in meat. Ammonia comes in meat. If you eat meat, you're eating ammonia. Period.
As a naturally occurring substance?
Yes, it is a naturally occurring substance. But he figured out a way to use an extra blast to kill E. coli bacteria. Eldon Roth was widely praised by the meat industry for running the most sanitary meatpacking plants in the country. He would buy carcasses from other packers and then turn those bits of meat in the same way, and this is the analogy I think you're referring to, since humans have stood upright, people who make food for their families have tried to use, frugal cooks have tried to use every single scrap. That's all he was doing. He was just using a centrifugal force to extract all the possible beef off of a carcass. That's all pink slime is. Again, it's lean, finely textured beef. All of the LFTB manufacturers except Roth went out of business, and he, last time I checked, is now only operating one of his plants. It pretty much destroyed him personally.
And this is stuff that people who eat meat have been eating for a long time. Like if you've had a chicken McNugget, you've eaten the chicken version. Am I right? I mean,
that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And what I found fascinating about the pink slime episode was that it just laid bare the extent to which the food critics are able to commandeer media resources. And I spent a lot of time researching the historical roots of this food critique group. I traced it back to the 1970s, no surprise there, and Ralph Nader. There's a big section in the book on it. They are extremely well organized. I give them all credit. They're smart people. They're well-intentioned people. Many of them are concerned more about the environment than anything else. But it was just a stunning example of the way a special interest group has managed to control the media message. And meat packers are they've just being left in the dust. They can't even figure out how to respond to it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ian in Dallas on the phone. Hi, Ian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with the point that consumers often ignore how much power they have to dictate policy using the power of their wallet. But I think also some blame needs to go to the meat industry for often misleading the public or omitting specific facts about where their meat comes from or how it's treated. And I wonder if your guest could talk a little bit about the sort of factory farm paradigm and the routine practices of hormones, antibiotics, and genetically modified corn as feed for the animals.
Thanks for your call. What'd you learn about that, Maureen?
Oh, boy. We only have about 5 minutes here. Where do I even start with that? I think that people now are fond of assuming and then accusing meatpackers of not giving information. Frankly, meatpackers will tell you what's going on. All you got to do is ask them. They'll tell you, they've gotten the message that they have to be, to use that current buzzword, more transparent. So, for example, Temple Grandin, the very well-known professor from Colorado who has helped design slaughter systems. She's the autistic woman who has a connection with animals.
Yeah, and they're made to be more humane, these shoots that she's developed.
Oh, well, yes, and packers have been working on that long before Temple Grandin came along, but she has been narrating a series of films that the packing industry has been making showing what actually goes on in a slaughtering house. Again, I think this is a case where there are always going to be what are called bad players. And I'm thinking of the guy whose name I'm totally forgetting, the Sparbo Eggs guy who has a big plant in Iowa, and apparently, I would never buy a Sparbo egg. So there are always bad players, but my take on the industry is that most meat packers can't afford, they just flat out cannot afford to be stupid enough to do something like the Sparbo guy did. And, and you notice that every time one of these films come up where someone's mistreating an animal, it's always a very small plant. There's always going to be bad players. As to antibiotics and hormones, I spend a lot of time on that in the book because I know that that's a very contentious subject. Those were tools that farmers adopted in the 1940s and 1950s to help reduce their production costs. It wasn't big corporations who brought that stuff in. It wasn't big corporations who shifted animals off pasture into confinement. Family farmers did that because they didn't have enough labor and their production costs had to be cut to a bare minimum if they wanted to earn a profit. Most livestock producers, by the way, don't get ag subsidies. So, you know, that's not part of their, you know, calculation when they're busy trying to figure out if they're going to earn a profit. Could everything be better in a perfect world? Yes. I do think that, and based on what I've learned from talking to people in the industry, nobody in the industry thinks antibiotics are going to be available for much longer. They're just prepared to lose those. And it's hard to say what will happen when they're gone. The cost of meat will go up. That might drive down consumption, in which case the price of meat will drop. It's, boy, we could spend the next 2 hours just, I mean, the caller had raised great issues. They're amazingly complicated.
Well, let me bring this up because I thought this was fascinating. As to the question of animals being raised in confinement and in these small mm-hmm. spaces, there was a time when environmentalists were saying using giant swaths of land to allow animals to be out at pasture is kind of a waste of natural resources. I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's worth noting that environmentalists have not always agreed on the best ways to do this.
That's right. Confinement, it took me a while to track down the history of confinement, but I found that, again, it originated on family farms on the part of farmers who didn't have enough labor. One thing that confinement does is significantly reduce the amount of labor because the animals are all right there. You don't have to keep going out to a field. You don't have to go find them, and you can use automation to feed them. The reason that they moved them into confinement was because the price of land was rising so high. Remember, farmers are competing with home builders, with highway makers, with shopping mall builders. I have a great quote in the book from a guy in the 1950s who said, I can't afford to keep my animals on pasture. I'm just going to move them into confinement. So there are lots of reasons why these systems happened. And in the 1960s, this I think just turned out to be one of the biggest surprises for me. In the 1960s, when Congress first passed clean water laws, environmentalists regarded confinement as the best way to protect soil, water, and air from agricultural pollution. They said, here's the deal. If we can just confine all this stuff, it will be much more manageable. So it's, you know, the way people looked at it then is not the way people are looking at it now. But I think it's important to keep all those complexities in mind rather than just condemning the system outright.
Maureen, do you mind sharing your personal history with meat consumption?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I'm my age matters in this. I am 60. People, I'm very old. And when I was living in Iowa City, Hippieville, back in the early 1970s, I stopped eating meat for political reasons. I'd never read Diet for a Small Planet, but someone must have told me about it because apparently that's the argument. I thought, man, it's really stupid to waste all this these resources eating meat. It's, you know, more efficient to eat food directly instead mm-hmm. of translating grain into beef or pork. And so I didn't eat meat for 25 years, but about 12 years ago, I don't know if my age was catching up to me or what, but I frankly really didn't feel very good. And it took me a while to figure out that I was actually just so protein deprived. Mm. So I guess I wasn't a smart vegetarian. And I don't eat very much meat. On average, Americans eat about 225 pounds a year. I eat 25 pounds. If everybody ate the way I would, people, we wouldn't have, you know, nearly the demand for meat.
Maureen Ogle is a historian and author of the new book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of the Carnivore in America. She joined us from the studios of WOI in Ames, Iowa. Maureen, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris, very much for having me on. I appreciate it. And thanks to the callers and tweeters, too.
Thanks. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.